Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today. Hi, fam. Welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast, because today we have a return brother of another mother, Mike Hetty, to do a deep dive with us on a topic that impacts us all, shame. What's the difference between shame and guilt? Or, riddle me this, is there a healthy, functional form of shame? Because when it comes to this conversation, how we think about or even understand toxic shame can shape our identity, behaviors, but also shame gets a bad rap, y'all. And did you know shame actually can provide insights on how to navigate our lives in healthier ways? Are you intrigued? I hope so, because I want to share all about this conversation with you. I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started. All right, family, welcome back. Welcome back. Happy Valentine's Day. I cannot believe it. I was just talking with somebody this week and I was like, isn't it interesting how January was like 800 days long and we've blinked and we're already halfway through February. It's wild. But today we have such a great episode, and I'm so excited to have Mike Hetty back with us. Mike is the co-owner and director of the Anxiety and Stress Disorders Institute, and he is an expert in the treatment of anxiety disorders and OCD. In addition to treatment, Mike is a sought-after clinical consultant for therapists looking to implement evidence-based treatments. And around here, around these parts, you might be familiar with Mike because he's come to hang out and chat with us, introduce us even to inference-based CBT, also known as ICBT. He's also hung out with the fam to talk about the differentiation, the nuanced differences, big and small, between generalized anxiety disorder and OCD. So if you're interested in checking out any of those past episodes, you certainly can jump on over to this episode's blog at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. I'm going to have all the deets on Mike, his past episodes, because I loved that, Mike, by the way, very on brand for today's talk. Allowing some room for healthy pride here. He is a sought-after clinical consultant, and at this point, Mike, we're friends. So I'm thrilled to welcome back Mike. I'm thrilled to be able to have this conversation with you today, fam. So what are we talking about? We're talking about shame. We're going to take some time to define shame, how it functions, the effects of it, and how we can work through it. So Mike's going to be talking with us about some key differences between shame and guilt. And then Mike's going to do something really cool. He's going to share with us about this concept of the compass of shame and how it can apply in our lives. Furthermore, we talk about the importance of self-compassion, but not overcorrecting with self-compassion, finding ways to have healthy pride, to invite humor into our lives, social connection, and a real biggie, shifting rigid self-expectations. So without further ado, let's dive in. Welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast. Today, fam, today we have a brother from another mother here that has been on the show quite a few times now, Mike Hetty. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Nicole. Thanks for having me back.
Of course. And today we're talking about shame. This is actually a subject that I want to say maybe even last year when you were going to come and chat and did come, family, you can check out those episodes and talked with us about generalized anxiety and differences between that and OCD. You had mentioned I give these presentations on shame and I asterisked the comment like in multiple asterisks and put it on my pegboard over here going, Yes, shame needs to be discussed because shame shows up in more than just OCD. Shame shows up, I would argue, most everywhere. And you have a very interesting way of unpacking and understanding shame that I think could be helpful for the family here. So we are going to be talking about all things shame today. But first, before we really dive in, I kind of wonder, because I think these get conflated sometimes and I find distinction, could we just broadly define shame and then differentiate what is shame versus guilt? Because I think those are the two things that get conflated quite a bit.
Yeah, it naturally comes up because they feel so similar. And that was certainly how I took it when I first was like, oh, guilt and shame were just synonyms, right? And it turns out, like, not only are they distinguishable in what we see people present with in the office as therapists, but in the actual research, they're quite distinct, despite appearing similar. So shame can broadly be defined as a core self-conscious internal experience. It might just be easier to call it a core self-conscious emotion. Mm-hmm. And it tends to be aversive or unpleasant by design,
right?
Intending to grab your attention and feed you information, if you will.
Right.
And it appears as though, I think this is consistent, the data, that it's pretty specific to social creatures. So with shame, if we think of like an analogy of like a spotlight, where does the spotlight focus? That would distinguish shame from other things. So in shame, the entire spotlight is on the self, right? It's like holding a floodlight to you, and it's on you and who you are, your identity, yourself, independent of other people, right? Who I am. That's what shame is trying to sort of focus on. And so that's the broad overview of shame, right? Then we can get into like sort of healthy and not healthy. But when we compare that against guilt, guilt is a self-conscious emotion that is focused on others. And what I mean by that is usually a person experiencing guilt has had some interaction with an other. And that other could be a deity, a god. It could be a pet. It could be a hypothetical other person, or it could be an actual other person, but it's another person. That's where the floodlight or the spotlight is focused. And it's about how my behavior hurt them. And so the focus is on them in the context of me hurting them.
You'd say it's on them more than the behavior itself?
Well, yeah, the behavior has to be considered in context, mm-hmm. right? So the behavior in context to the other. For example, when people feel guilty, it tends to create what they call pro-social behaviors, which is just a fancy way of saying advantageous behaviors, apology to the other person, mm-hmm. reconciliation, repair, you know, contrition. These are all things that mend social relationships once you've realized you've been a party to hurting that other person. So it leads to pro-social behaviors. If we compare that to shame, we don't tend to see pro-social behavior because it's not about other people. We tend to see self-corrective or self-reflective behaviors. So making sure you're aligned with the kind of person you want to be, staying in alignment with your values is very different than apologizing to another person. You can see how they can riff off of each other, right? Like this is why it can get so cloudy. I would make the claim that guilt will always provoke shame, because if you've done something to real or not real harm another person, real or perceived, you're also going to have a self-reflective process.
Yeah.
So yes, I have to apologize to that person. My behavior hurt that person. I feel guilty for hurting that person. I need to fix that. But also it causes you to then go, but I hurt another person. What does that say about me? Right? What does that say about myself, my identity? So I would argue that that direction makes sense, but that someone can actually feel shame without feeling guilt. Someone can feel private internal shame from a dream, and there's absolutely no other. There's no real other person. There's no apology. There's no pro-social behavior. The spotlight is entirely on you. So I do think there's a directionality to this. And there is some research to suggest that shame is at the core of self-conscious emotions, And that other things bubble up from that, like embarrassment and guilt and humiliation and chagrin, but they're all sort of tethered together by that core piece of shame.
Yeah. So in terms of, like, if we were to make a Venn diagram out of all those descriptors, the overlap would be the shame, more or less, in the sense that they can all kind of touch upon that, but they can also be mutually exclusive, right?
Yes. I don't have any empirical data to back this up, but I would think if you're going to feel guilt, you're probably also going to feel shame. I think that's probably most likely to occur. But that's not true the other way around, that you can absolutely feel shame without feeling guilt.
Interesting. Right? Well, so overall, I would say I would agree, and I wouldn't expect to disagree. But are you familiar with Brené Brown?
Yes.
Okay, I love Brené.
I've seen her TED Talks. I thought they were wonderful. I haven't read her books.
Okay, I've read a number of her books, and she's a shame researcher, so she has a lot to say on this subject. But I tend to think of shame and guilt similar to how she will prose it, and that is to say, guilt is I did something bad, shame is I am bad. And I really jived with that definition, but in the definition you're talking about, it's really guilt is more a response in that behavior that happens between you and other. So it's not a self, like you can't have made a choice for yourself and been like, oh, I'm guilty of that. I was being selfish, whatever. And then move on and it doesn't stick around. Like, okay, I made a choice that resulted in this and I feel bummed about that for, you know, a little bit and metabolize it and move on. Or do you see it as, yeah, it really needs to be between you and the other and it's that response to other? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I don't disagree with Brené Brown's definition. It's actually a really common definition, but what I find missing is that it presumes that shame is not particularly functional or that it doesn't have a value, right? That it's just this thing that says you're bad. So I did something bad versus I am bad. It's a gross distinction. And I think that that makes sense. But I would actually say the distinction that was made in that definition is between guilt and toxic shame. I think we're missing an entire area where we understand that there is actually a lot of healthy shame reactions out there that are entirely valuable and helpful and advantageous to us as people. And they're distinct from guilt reactions because they're about the self. So like much like we would have anxiety and anxiety disorder, right?
Familiar.
Right. So anxiety disorder, the problem is that you have a particular way of interacting with anxiety. And that anxiety occurs in a context that isn't necessarily useful or real or reasonable. And then your reactions to it become the problem. So we treat the disordered piece of it, but we don't say, you know, that anxiety is bad. We say there's a context. And I would argue the same is true of any emotion, that that shame isn't inherently bad, that there's a context under which it's bad. And that's the nuance that I think is missing. And the reason I think we should care is that if we're going to treat shame, what is the outcome we're looking for? Are we looking to never feel it again? That every time shame pops up, we smack it with the self-compassion hammer? Like, what's the outcome goal? If we don't understand that we're going to return to a normal functional shame, just like we're going to return to a normal functional anxiety. So anyway, I might be reading into that definition a little bit more than is intended to, but you know, I think that the definition represents a toxic shame and not so much a broader understanding of shame as just a generic self-conscious emotion.
Well, and I imagine for a lot of listeners, their ears picked up and were like, what? There's different kinds of shame. And generally, it is a more pejorative word. The connotation of shame is probably thought of as what I would imagine you're describing as toxic shame. So perhaps understanding, okay, what is the difference then between healthy shame and toxic shame? Please share with the class because we're all interested.
Share with the class. Yes, I used to be a teacher, so I'll do that.
There you go.
Sharing with the class. So there's a lot of ways of trying to pull these apart, but I think there's three useful categories to think about between sort of healthy functional shame and toxic shame. So I'll define healthy shame and understanding that its inverse is actually toxic shame. And then we can go into a much more detailed sort of what we're going to call the compass of shame later.
Well, can so, I ask a quick question then? Yeah. With it being an inverse, would you say it's like two sides of the same coin, or is it not as concrete as that? Is it more of a spectrum that moves back and forth, or is that just not the way to think about it?
That's an interesting question that I don't know that I have an answer to. I like the idea of thinking of it as sort of a flexible process where you can kind of move in and out of toxic shame based on certain qualities, circumstances. But I think in these distinctions I'm going to put up that they're pretty black and white.
Okay.
And I just do that for ease, right? There's always nuance to these things.
That's fine. I will just note, family, like my little alarm bell, because I can be, as a lived experience person with LCD, a black and white thinker, that when I do see it kind of in two, it's either yes or no, it's this or that, then I go, oh, is that my brain? I have to do that cross check there. So that's helpful. Okay. So without further ado then, Mike, I'm not going to interrupt you on sharing right. this. Please share. Right.
The distinctions are, one, that healthy functional shame is time limited. It has an end point. And we'll give examples. It has an end point. It's not the Energizer Bunny. It doesn't keep going and going and going, right? So it's time limited. So the inverse of that is that toxic shame is ruminative. It never seems to end. You can always just pick up with it 6 years later when you remember the thing uh-huh. that you feel shame about. So it doesn't actually have an end point. You don't close the book and put it back on the shelf. The book is always lying open, ready for you to sort of continue to read it over and over again. So time limited is part one of identifying healthy functional shame. Two, it is functional, meaning it points to something. Functional shame is an emotion like anything else. Emotions, as Susan David eloquently says, are data, not directives, right? And a lot of people focus on the second part of that definition. It's not directives. You don't have to go listen to it and go do what you think makes sense. But the first part is what I want to focus on. It's data. It's information. Emotions are information. And they're either telling us something that is useful, or they're telling us something and it's not useful, but they're telling us something. So functional shame is useful. It's pointing towards something, right? It's trying to alert you to something. Now, that something might be a bad dream, or that something might be that you did something that would warrant shame, mm-hmm. right? That was very inconsistent with who you are, with your agreed upon values. Mm-hmm. So within this, as we see, its functional effect is that it leads to people being a little bit more self-reflective, curious about themselves, and which can lead to self-correction if they happened to have done something sort of wrong, so to speak.
Can I ask a clarifying question real quick on that? And overall, I really like the point of shame, or just even more broadly, emotions are data, not directive. But then as you were explaining it, you were like, see, it's data. It's pointing to something, and pointing and directive sound very, very much in line with... So can you distinguish for people? Because I think I understand the nuanced difference, but I know some people might go, did you just say it's not directive, but it's pointing somewhere? Like, is it that directive? Like, so if you could clarify that.
Yeah. To sort of draw a line that might be somewhat permeable, alerting to you that there is something that was detected, right, is different than saying you must go do something.
Yes, yes.
I think telling someone to go do something reflexively is almost always a bad idea with emotions, because you miss an important piece of what the alert was about. The alert is simply, hey, I have information for you, right? And then you get to decide what to do with that information should you choose to look at it. The directive piece is sort of the must do or ought to do a particular behavior when you feel this way, like a run and avoid or control this. And no. Right? Like, we're just looking at this fact that right now we're just trying to look at it as information.
Yeah.
Again, permeable lines, because I hear what you're saying about directive. And it's not my quote, but I like it.
Yeah, no, I like it. And I think you distinguished and operationalized those differences there well, because it's kind of like going and getting an oil change, and they run whatever degree amount of tests, they check the air in your tire or whatever. Saying what the number in your tire is data. It's not directly saying put in more air. Right. And it's being able to interpret the data, then we determine if we need to take further action versus, and so it pointed to that based on the raw data it gave you. It's either lower than it should be or just right, et cetera. And so I think that is a helpful distinction. So you were telling us then there's three parts to healthier shame. And so it's time limited. And then you were talking about this second piece that we were just talking about, right?
Right, that it's functional.
That it's functional. And then was there one last part to that?
Right. The third one is that it is specific to an event. So the healthy shame represents an event, not an identity. So maybe you cheated on a test. No one ever knew, but you knew. And you knew that was against what you're about. And you feel particularly upset with yourself for having crossed that line. And in this example, it's time limited in the sense that if it's healthy shame, you're not going to be thinking about this 3 months down the line, that you will have resolved going, okay, that was this one time. The functional relationship was, how do I set up so I don't cheat again? So it's self-corrective. And then the last part being about this event and not a broad sweeping generalization about your identity or who you are. I'm not a cheater. I cheated. And that I can sort of now understand my shame inside this context in a way that is actually valuable to me.
I think that's actually, as you described it, I was like, that's how I was conceptualizing guilt in the example I gave you before. So if that were the case, then I was really conceptualizing it between what you would describe as toxic shame and healthy shame. Because I'm thinking about, those things that you can metabolize even to self, right? Not necessarily to other. And you can say, oh, yeah, that was wrong of me. And then make the shift or knock it off or whatever the thing is to not do that again. And it doesn't become this bigger blown out thing that, 6 years later, you are waking up in the middle of the night and you're like, remember when I was a horrible person?
Yeah. And again, in any example, to sort of echo back to what I was saying before, I do think that when you do a bad behavior and there is an other, in this case, maybe you're cheating on the test, threw the curve off in the class. I don't know. Or you felt disrespectful to the class rules. There is an other, so it's not entirely just a shame experience, but the shame is when you put the spotlight onto yourself.
Yeah.
So it's less about apologizing to the class, apologizing to the structure of the classroom and the students, and more about sort of looking at yourself and going, okay, I broke my own rule and I have feelings about that. And we call that shame,
yeah.
Right? So it's a kind of fine distinction,
yeah.
But it makes a lot more sense when we start thinking about it from a toxic perspective, because that distinction grows larger when we look at it from that perspective. So guilt is apologize and repair with another person because you hurt them. Shame is repair with yourself because you hurt yourself.
Okay. In the healthy context. And then
in the healthy
toxic
context.
Is going to be the never-ending ruminating form of shame that is probably what people associate with their idea of shame when you say it. Largely, people are thinking of toxic shame.
Right. So if we look at the opposite, if you will, of the three categories I put out there, the opposite of those is the toxic shame. So we already established that toxic shame isn't time limited. It's ruminative. It is always available because I've never reconciled it, so to speak. It's not functional because it doesn't lead you to self-correction or self-reflection. It doesn't build insight. If anything, we'll find that toxic shame never actually looks at the information as information. Toxic shame immediately goes into self-punishment, immediately goes into self-criticism, immediately goes into forms of self-punishment like isolation, secrecy. These are all things that lead to more toxic stuff, and we'll get into a breakdown of that. And then, of course, the opposite of it being specific to an event is that it is global to who you are. So again, it's not that I cheated, it's that I'm a cheater. And when you start to globalize that, you paint with this really huge brush, and that has serious implications, right, for mental health.
Yeah. Yes. Broad brush strokes rarely solve things. Yeah, it is interesting to think about that. And similar, as you were saying before, particularly within OCD, we will see how people fear the distress, typically manifesting as anxiety. It can manifest other ways, but they fear that distress or fear the fear itself. And those have functional uses for us. You know, our brains were built to be able to survive the bear attack by not getting into the fight with the bear. Why? Because we felt that threat and we were able to respond accordingly. But it gets so identified as the enemy, as I shouldn't be feeling anxious. And so part of the learning and treatment and part of the healing and recovery is realizing, no, actually, anxiety is anxiety. I don't have to do anything with it. Like you were saying before, it's data. It's not directive to go act on this as if a bear is here and we're getting into a bear fight. And so in a similar way, then shame has those functional pieces, which feels very counterintuitive to say. Shade on shame. Because shame feels like taboo. Shame feels different in a way.
It does. Yeah. I mean, feeling shame, it's sort of synonym humiliation. It is incredibly painful. And it usually prompts us to want to react in some way. And I also think that we are sort of products of messaging sometimes. And the messaging in the self-help world, the messaging in the popular psychology world is rarely nuanced, right? Yeah. And so sound bites are king. And what gets lost inside the sound bites is like, shame bad, you know, beat it with the self-compassion hammer. And I'm being hyperbolic, obviously, to draw the point, which is that if we're not curious about the experience and we're just reacting with interventions, then we're missing something. Because right. sometimes you are in a threatening situation and anxiety is reasonable. We don't want to do exposure when we're actually in a threatening situation. It doesn't make sense, right? So not all anxiety is disordered. And not all shame is something that we need to immediately work on. In fact, our normal response to healthy shame is probably enough, but we don't tend to sort of take note of it. We don't tend to remember it. It doesn't stick. What sticks is the really prolonged toxic shame or the long-term, long-standing shame.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to think about, and I'm sure as everybody listening, you and I as well, we all have our different experiences having particularly toxic shame, but we have had these experiences of healthy shame, maybe not thought of it as shame per se, but have had these kind of self-corrective moments, etc. It's interesting because last fall I was interviewing Dr. Pia Callison on metacognitive therapy. And what's interesting is she's talking about the way we think about our feelings. And I feel like toxic shame could quickly become a belief system that is almost the way you filter a thought from. If you globally, like you were saying before, meaning family, like if you're just like, this is who I am. It's not just a part of me. It's a polluted kind of, it is what it is. Then part of your belief system and how you conceptualize things, when shame is that filter in which you're kind of processing through, can become quite problematic. And I actually think that happens quite a lot for people where they have different experiences and shame can become that filter that people end up engaging in more self-punishment or derision or secrecy, judgment, all of those things. And so how do we help it not become a belief system filter? Because that's a shitty filter, guys. We don't want that filter. That's the toxic filter. We keep healthy shame. Let that be there, but let it be a litmus test for us when we need it. But how do we work with that?
Yeah. I mean, that is the clinical question. I think it starts with education. You know, as a good sort of CBT-oriented therapist, if we don't understand the boundaries of the problem, we can't sort of figure it out at that level, then we're having a really hard time responding to it, right? Like when you're talking about it becoming a filter, the word that comes up for me is just a reflexive response. It's just what we do because we never thought to think differently about it. We never challenged it. It appears true. It feels true. I can justify it with all of these individual examples that, you know, you know, 1 + 1 adds to me being a bad person. And that's sort of a reflexive reaction. So step one is to understanding that there is actually a healthy shame. There's a toxic shame. And that gets people thinking, okay, then that's healthy. Then what's toxic? Oh, then we'll get into all the different forms of toxic shame. More specifically, the things you do that likely create toxic shame when we talk about the compass. And that sets up where we can then create a choice point, to borrow an ACT phrase, where I could easily go back into that reflexive space, right? So we're talking about deliberate practice because now I'm aware of what's going on. I can label what's happening. Mm-hmm. I can find the edges between healthy and not healthy, even if it's just a theoretical understanding at this point. I see the two definitions. And then we create a choice point to go, okay, if these behaviors lead to toxic shame, then these other behaviors probably lead to healthy shame, and practicing those new behaviors. But it starts with knowing the difference and spotting the problem.
It kind of reminds me of ICBT in the sense of slowing down the brain process and realizing how you got to those perimeters or the boundaries of where shame started and ended. I know it's different, but also it does sound like just the importance of slowing down and realizing, how did I come to this conclusion? Where did this belief start? Where does it carry over into all of that?
That broadly can be described as curiosity. And I feel like there's actually a decent amount of data that suggests that the sort of the mindset of curiosity is so much less linked to mental health concerns because it's not rigid, it's not judgmental, it's not reactive. Curiosity is open. Curiosity is like, let's see what it has to say. Let's be curious. So if we can understand a curiosity mindset by a deliberate effort or practice, now that we know that we can, it might lead to a very different set of reactions to that shame and understanding even where it came from. Because again, if shame came from a bad dream, or shame came because society has a bullshit rule that's causing you to feel shame for yourself, well, I'd like to know that it's coming from a bullshit rule or came from a dream. But if I'm just reflexively responding to any shame provocation without understanding where it came from, then I'm doomed to keep repeating this unhelpful process, which we'll lay out in the compass.
Yeah. It's interesting too, because as you were talking about it more broadly, it's being curious. And a lot of times in therapy, that's kind of what our job is, you know, to explore with curiosity and help our brain be able to learn from that. But I feel like part of this is culturally in society is reinforced, because there's a real curiosity problem nowadays. If you don't agree or don't see something the way I'm seeing it, or you're doing it a different way, rather than learn why, it immediately jumps into judgment. You bad, me right, you wrong. Okay, I'm painting with a broad stroke here. Not every situation. But it is really hard to be curious, and especially when it's a very important thing to you, to be curious about how we or others are coming to different conclusions. But it's such an important thing. And really, the practice can start even within ourselves, allowing ourselves to be curious how we're coming to the conclusions that we are. And we may still after that go, yep, and that was right. Or in the case of toxic shame, nope, this came from this person's rule or this dream or this source. I would imagine trauma impacts shame quite a bit, because I feel a lot of people do kind of look back and they can go, well, I had this significant event that really shaped me on this, and I haven't been the same since. So I would imagine there's a large interplay there, although you can have shame for sure, toxic shame, without having trauma history.
Yeah, I think it certainly complicates it for people too, because, you know, traumatic event that gets interpreted to be about a thing you are, like I am this way, is incredibly painful. And again, how the mind uses it against you to justify these conclusions about yourself, which ultimately aren't accurate, right? Like rarely is it the case that my toxic shame in particular was right. I mean, I would argue that it's always wrong, because of how it came about. But it is interesting how the human mind, it's easier to go into judgment. It's easier to not be curious. Maybe it even feels safer because curiosity leads to vulnerability.
Yeah. And Brené Brown is big on that because she will talk about empathy is the antidote to shame. And that's based out of being vulnerable, allowing space to understand self and other. And yeah, it's definitely different because what she would construct around shame too is that judgment, secrecy, and really that isolation, the silence, is what reinforces and kind of allows shame to grow. If we were thinking like mold grows in moist conditions, you know, this is where shame can breed and grow, is in silence and secrecy and judgment. So it sounds like those align too in terms of the perspectives. Not that you have to match Brené's, but just that's my context.
I mean, it's good company to keep, right?
Yes, it is.
You know, I would certainly want to question myself if I was going off in a very wildly different direction. And I'm not entirely sure I completely disagree with her definition. I don't know that she draws a fine line between shame and toxic shame. And again, it's not always necessary to do that. It's just when you're really struggling with it, a lot of times the nuance can be valuable. That what's the end goal? That we humans never feel shame? Well, that's just not going to happen.
Right.
And
that's
do
a
we always want to
battle from the start?
Yeah. Yeah. Do we always want to label it as bad? That's like, should we humans never feel pain of any kind? Well, it's inevitable. It's a part of the human condition. You don't have to like it, but it's there. There's signal value to these experiences. Curiosity is better than reactivity. So now we want to just figure out, even from just like a self-help perspective, like what are the things that help me think I'm doing sort of a really good toxic shame? Like, if I want to do an Olympic level toxic shame, like what are those ingredients? And that can help us figure out.
Yeah. All right, Bam. If you're getting value out of our conversation, but you haven't hit subscribe or followed OCD Family Podcast, wherever you enjoy your podcasts and YouTube, please take a moment, no time like the present, to hit that button. It's free, it's easy, and it ensures that not only will you never miss an episode, but that more folks can find the OCD Family community. Because fam, we know we're better together. Now, back to today's chat. So that's actually a good segue because you were referencing this idea of a compass in terms of a tool to help locate problematic responses and relationships to shame. And so tell us more about the tool or tools that could be helpful in navigating this.
Sure. Now, this is not even close to my idea. This is coming from a psychoanalyst in the late 80s, Donald Nathanson, who probably spent most part of his latter career researching shame from a sort of analytic affect theory perspective. And without diving into all of that, because it's complicated, what I think is one of the most useful things that came out of his observational work was something he called the compass of shame. And so I'll describe it now because it's an incredibly valuable tool for therapists, for individuals. The compass is a standard compass with the north, south, east, and west sort of dial or the poles that represent those directions. And in each of those four directions, he describes four responses. So the first response, you can put it in the north position if you want, is what they called withdrawal. Sometimes in the animal kingdom referred to as appeasement behaviors. But withdrawal, I like to think of it as the person getting quiet, silent, and small. It's to sort of shrink away.
Yeah.
So a common example of this is sort of, and I've used this example a lot, but I think it's a good one, is, you know, you think you saw someone you knew and you kind of shouted and waved your hand at them. And as you got closer, it wasn't them. And a natural response to that is to then go sort of shut up, to close your mouth, to sort of avert your eyes and to sort of want to not be there. And that's a kind of reaction that we would call withdrawal, being quiet, silent, and small. That isn't the one we tend to focus on. Maybe we're talking about assertiveness training and all that kind of stuff, but that's there. That's a common response. Mm-hmm. The second one, you can put this in any position you like. I put it in the south position, is avoidance. And as anxiety specialists understand avoidance inside and out, avoidance of people, places, and things that reflect shame for you, that maybe prompted the shame, avoidance of the emotion itself altogether. right? And then I also throw into this perfectionism. I think perfectionism as an action is more commonly associated with trying to avoid feeling ashamed, feeling humiliated, feeling embarrassed than it is about, say, fear or danger. I think it's about avoiding what they would call the one down position. You know, so if you asked a kid, why do you need perfect attendance? Why does it feel so important to have perfect attendance? It's not like a fear danger thing. It's like a status thing. It's, you know, it's an expectation. It's a signal of who I am, that if somehow if I don't have perfect attendance, then I'm not good enough. And so I do think that a lot of perfectionism, and this is actually noted in the work of compassion-focused therapy, Paul Gilbert and company, they recognize perfectionism as a common reaction to what they call high shame, and it's worth assessing for. So that's in the South Pole. So sort of look at, am I a perfectionist? What's driving that?
Right. I just have to say, that's a very interesting thought. I'm going to have to chew on that one. It's interesting.
Chew on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, I'm not saying that's all perfectionism is. I just think it's a lot of what we see, that perfectionism is so much more about avoiding a one down position to prevent myself from being embarrassed, humiliated, feeling shame, feeling like not good enough. You know, it's not really about achievement in the sense of people who are like, I am going to strive towards excellence, right? Mm-hmm. Pursuing excellence is different than perfectionism.
Yeah.
Perfectionism is rigid. It's very commonly associated with mental health problems, right? Rarely is it that you see a self-help book that's like, let's improve your perfectionism,
right?
As an antidote to sort of how you're feeling, be more perfectionistic. Now, that tends to be a signal that there's a larger problem.
Yeah. But fear could be a motivator in that as well. I guess it just, again, highlights the importance of zooming out and looking at the function of it. But I absolutely can see how avoidance would function to avoid a myriad of shame responses. It could also be FOMO and less about, I guess, embarrassment and more about what if I don't get to have this really great experience and what am I going to miss and am I going to be okay, et cetera. I mean, it could manifest, it seems like, in different ways, but it's a very interesting food for thought there.
Yeah, I think at the very least it should be provoking curiosity in people who are listening. Oh, maybe this actually is how it's functioning for me or my client. So the third pole, if you put it in sort of whatever the West position, is attacking others. Attacking others can be quite literal. You're aggressive and violent. It could be that you're giving someone the silent treatment or that you're gossiping about other people. But the attacking others is usually in the context of, I feel like someone has made me feel ashamed, mm-hmm. made me feel small or not smart or not capable. And this is my retaliation, is to make others feel small, not smart, not capable, right? So I'm going to attack their character. I'm going to attack something about them. But that attacking others is a very common response to feeling shame.
Yeah.
And Nathanson's done a lot of writing about that. And the one that I think we want to focus the most on, at least in the work that we see within OCD and anxiety disorders, is attacking the self. This is self-criticism, self-punishment. This is holding your character up to some kind of unfair scrutiny. And within that, we tend to see most people going, oh yeah, I totally am utterly mean to myself.
Right.
And so if we looked at all four of those things, it becomes kind of a questionnaire of sorts. Like, okay, I know I have felt shame. Which of those four, or how many of those four, do I check off that I do when I feel that sense of shame? Do I avoid? Do I attack others? Do I attack myself? And that leads us to, we can call it treatment planning, or just coming up with a different, more helpful response. It's like, well, what's the opposite or the more helpful response to some of those?
Yeah, it's interesting. Criticism, a lot of people would argue that it's functional. It may not be a healthy functional, but it is functional in the sense of whether reward or punishment, the brain is learning through that reinforcement model, even if it is in a self-punishing way. And I don't think it's an awesome way of handling it, but it is, I think most people can relate and go, well, yeah, I mean, I feel like, okay, I have to be harder. I have to be stricter on myself. I have to allow myself less joy, less freedom to do things a certain way because I don't deserve it, etc. And then outside sources can reinforce and be like, okay, that's better. That's right. That's what we expect of you. And so people will feel, or at least get this sense, that it is functioning for them in some way, similar to, you know, a kid that's having a tantrum, getting attention. It's negative attention seeking, but it's functional in a way. And so, again, we have to learn how to combat that with providing positive attention or whatever the thing is. And so what would you say to that?
Yeah, well, it's a really common response. And I think Kristen Neff elaborated on this in her TED Talk when she talked about self-compassion, is that some people conflate self-compassion with being indulgent, and they see that as the opposite of accountability. And so what you're describing, at least in some of your descriptions, was being accountable, right? Like, I need to set new boundaries for myself. You know, being accountable and being self-corrective are in the same camp. We want self-correction if, in fact, we did do something that we didn't want to do. Self-correction, accountability makes sense. But to conflate self-criticism with accountability is problematic, right? Because self-criticism is this, again, there's no patience, there's no kindness. The fundamental purpose is to hurt yourself, but it's masquerading as self-corrective. I'm going to hurt myself until I fix it. And again, I think this is a flawed but common reaction. So we want to do a little thought experiment here, which is, at what grade should we teach our own children this incredibly valuable tool of self-criticism? If it's so useful, if it is akin to accountability, then what, fifth grade health class is an entire section on how to do a really good self-criticism? And everyone's ears are on fire going, I would never, right, ever teach my kid that. But then they have to look into the mirror and go, but I do it to myself daily. So why the discrepancy? Why would I never teach my kid that, but yet I use it on myself every day? And this is, again, a part of that reflexive pattern that people have. They've never stopped and been curious. There's a different way to go about this, that accountability is not the same thing as self-criticism. And I'd actually argue that self-compassion is so much more in line with accountability, right? Because it is not, in its appropriate use, it is not reflexive. It is based on curiosity and non-judgment. So that's what I would normally try to get people to understand, that self-criticism masquerades as self-correction. It masquerades as accountability, but it actually doesn't function that way at all, right? Because if it did, you would be able to see it end. Oh, my self-correction worked. Now I'm done. Or my self-punishment worked. My self-criticism worked. Now I'm done. It rarely works. You do it until you get tired or distracted.
Right.
Right. It doesn't really work, because if it worked, we'd teach kids, deliberately teach them how to do it, right, not through modeling.
There'd be curriculums on it. You're right.
Yeah. 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 There'd be a ton of papers written about how the value of self-criticism on today's youth, right? Like, no.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think it's a helpful thought. And it's one of many things where we can get caught up and say we would never treat other people the way that sometimes we police ourselves. And so is that accountability? No, not equating that to accountability. I mean, accountability can have that self-correcting behavior. But also, if you're looking at the function of it, and the function is because I'm not deserving of this because I enter shame belief, then it's functioning more in a self-punishment way. Yeah. And family, I'll note too, earlier Mike was saying the answer isn't to just beat something down with the self-compassion stick. And self-compassion is a great tool. But I think your point there more was, we can't just overcorrect and say, okay, any existence of shame, we just have to hit with self-compassion. We have to be curious. But self-compassion is a huge tool to have in the tool belt.
Yeah. Dr. Kristen Neff and Dr. Chris Germer have a lot of sort of self-help book instructions on self-compassion. And then there's an entire, you know, empirically supported treatment called compassion-focused therapy,
yeah,
which is, I would argue, a more comprehensive psychotherapy towards people who tend to be incredibly high shame individuals, toxic shame individuals, perfectionistically shamed individuals. And it's a larger curriculum than just non-judgmental awareness and building up self-compassion skills, as Neff and Germer strive for.
Well, that is very helpful. That compass gives us a good understanding in terms of how toxic shame can function. And so that moves us into even thinking about some of the expectations and belief that might even set up that toxic shame to start with. What would you say there?
Yeah. So it's not enough to just sort of know that there's healthy shame and there's toxic shame and it looks like this and it feels like that. And these are some of the behaviors associated with it that we have, we'll call them vulnerabilities, right? And within that could be a whole host of things, having other mental health issues, having an attachment issue, being traumatized, bullied, neglected as a child. These are all sort of things that set up vulnerabilities that can lead to toxic shame reactions. But to highlight specifically this idea of rigid perfectionistic beliefs or expectations of the self, I must be, you know, a good student. And what you mean by a good student is all A's, right? The problem with this is that you don't get to control your grades. And so if your expectation is a good student gets all A's, and that's my expectation for myself, you're going to fail, or you're highly likely to fail. The same thing goes.
Or you don't fail at a big cost to yourself.
Yeah.
Because you have to give up a lot to try and make these hurdles of someone else's expectations of you.
Exactly. Like competing expectations. Like I want to have a robust social life and be a great friend. And I also want to get straight A's. Sure. Maybe a few people could do that. But most of us only have so much time and energy to put into those things. So again, what it points out is that these are unworkable in the long run. Anything perfectionistic is unworkable in the long run. Anything rigid and scrupulous is unworkable in the long run because it sets you up for not only a likely failure in meeting those expectations, but then you have a crash because now it challenges your entire identity. Who I am as a person is now challenged because of this, right? So I'm going to be the kind of person who has really successful relationships, never screws up in relationships. Again, you're half of that equation and you can't know that. So what I've heard a lot from people, and these are across different problems, is that there's a lot of these perfectionistic and rigid expectations or beliefs they have about the world, themselves, others, that if they never look at them again, if they never sort of challenge them, then they're just there operating in the background, like old coding. And if that old coding is running, eventually is wearing your battery down. And we need to sort of go in there and fix that because it's not serving you to sort of be like, oh yeah, you know, I'm a person who never gets challenged with a mental health problem. Yeah, maybe not at 18,
right?
But we can't set that up and use that as some kind of rigid marker. So those beliefs need to be spoken out loud, shine some light on them so that we can hear them reflected back to us. And that's sometimes what you hear in therapy is your therapist will say something like, so what you're saying is that, you know, your value as a person is completely connected to your GPA. And they hear that and they go, well, that's ridiculous.
Right.
But kind of. And now, okay, well, let's just get curious about that. How might that be serving this larger issue we're working on, which is your toxic shame, your depression, your anxiety disorder? So that's where I think that is valuable, is sort of those things that we internalize as maybe even as kids and adolescents that our parents hold us to, that we think our schools hold us to, society might hold us to. I can't ever be, you know, a weird person. I'm not allowed to sort of be weird. And I mean that in an affectionate way, because society says weird is bad, but maybe I am kind of different. And isn't that okay? Like, again, if you were to sort of talk to someone who came to you and says, hey, this is me and society doesn't like me, generally speaking, you would probably say, you do you.
Right.
Right.
I feel like a lot of the autistic community feels it, and the medical model can feel very shaming in that way because they can very much say, okay, I'm trying to be me. And you're telling me like it's not good enough. You're telling me to fit in your box here. And the reality is it's just a different way of processing. And we would in that situation be like, yeah, you do you, you know, screw that.
Because there's nothing wrong with it.
Right.
Right. Like what's wrong with it? Yeah, what's wrong with it is that there's a societal structure that hasn't caught up to reality yet. And that societal structure, and you can say this with the LGBTQ population as well,
so
right?
Many like intersections, yeah.
There's so many intersections here where it's like, wait a minute, like society will catch up, hopefully, right? But now, especially in certain areas of the world and in the country, like it's not okay. And by okay, I mean the neurotypical or the 1950s mindset or whatever it is. It's not okay to be you, but it actually is okay to be you.
Right.
And so sometimes we internalize messages, we internalize expectations, we internalize beliefs that lead us down the road to eventually having a toxic shame relationship to who we are. But that's what I was saying at the beginning of our interview, was that sometimes it's bullshit.
Right.
Right? That shame is coming from a place of pure bullshit, that you would never put that onto someone else. It's like the right way to sort of see yourself or the world. But if you never look, if you never get curious, then it never really gets addressed.
And it's really challenging then when it's not just, I had this thought or a dream or this bad experience with somebody telling me this, but it's a cultural phenomenon, or it's the DSM-5, or it's whatever entity going, no, no, this isn't normal from an analytic point of view. Because how do you then sort out what should be internalized and what should not be internalized? And I'm not making a case that you shouldn't embrace yourself as you for any neurodivergent processing. But I think it gets fuzzy then in terms of shame, sometimes when it's reinforced on these broader societal levels, how to take what's useful and not have things that are not useful or not functional defining you. Do you know what I mean? It gets tricky. It gets muddy.
Yeah. Well, all of this is tricky and muddy, to be fair, right? If it were easy, then it would just be obvious, but it's not obvious. It's tricky for people. And I think if we can keep it as simple as possible, despite losing sometimes information when we keep things too simple, if the shame, if we're curious about the shame experience, if it's trying to tell us something and we go, okay, what are you trying to tell me? Where'd you come from? And it's trying to tell you that in the dream you had, you cheated on your partner, we instantly go, oh, well, that doesn't matter because it's a dream.
Right.
And then you move on with your life. And although it gets a little bit more palpable and potent when you say, oh, like society doesn't think you should have equal rights, or society doesn't think you should exist, and you feel shame about that. It's like, yeah, but I'm an okay person and society is crap, right? And so like, okay, so I'd like to know that it's coming from this. That doesn't necessarily resolve the problem that society's not fixed, but I don't need to carry around a weight that isn't mine.
Right?
Yeah. And I'm not saying it's simple. It's always complicated. It's always nuanced. But as our conversation is most benefited from going, there are distinctions that can be made that improve how we respond. If it's not that I actually did something that is opposite of what I genuinely think was not what I should do, then it's fair to say often that leads to hopefully better self-reflection and self-correction and understanding and insight. In a toxic relationship, it won't. In a toxic relationship, it'll just get thrown into the standard thing, and you're going to have the standard responses to it, and then it'll just sort of ruminate.
Ruminate, right. Hey, real talk. If you've made it this far into the pod, chances are you love learning about OCD. So why not take it up a notch? Head over to OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to browse the OCD Training School's incredible lineup. And when you use my special link, you're not just investing in great education, you're also supporting this podcast at zero extra costs. With courses ranging from self-help to continuing education for clinicians, offering live and on-demand options to fit your needs or your time zone, the opportunities are vast. OCD Training School has your back. And when you use my link, you have the fam's back too. So go check it out at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And now, back to the show. So in terms of understanding and having a better foundation for how toxic shame can operate, how it interplays with these expectations, etc., then let's look at the therapeutic responses to toxic shame. And I know that you've indicated with self-compassion, spoiler alert, that's going to be on the list, I'm sure. But let's talk about what are the therapeutic approaches. If we have this general distinction compass to understand how toxic shame is functioning, what do we do?
Yeah. Perfect. I think self-compassion is always a part of this conversation because it's directly going in the opposite direction of self-criticism, self-punishment, and broad sweeping accusations about the self, right? Self-compassion is about common humanity, which is the opposite of sort of isolation and secrecy. So self-compassion hits a lot of points. And again, self-compassion is more than just I read a definition and now I'm self-compassionate. Self-compassion is a multiple times a day self-reflective practice where I have this habitual reaction to negative emotional experiences in my life, and I'm trying to create another reaction, a self-compassionate, patient, understanding reaction. And it takes work and it takes effort. So I'm going to put that out there. It's like, yeah, that is a necessary condition for changing all of these points on the compass of challenging beliefs about the self. That's a necessary condition, but I don't know that it's sufficient. I think because self-compassion has been in the vernacular for so long, a lot of people, especially in the blue-collar community that I come from, don't take kindly to the word self-compassion because they think of it as just, you know, it's too soft of a word. They don't align with it. It doesn't make sense to them. So in circumstances like that, I'll be less interested in using the word self-compassion and just describing what it is. I'll say things like, well, over here, you're kind of a jerk to yourself.
Yeah.
Right? You have absolutely no patience for yourself. Right? And I don't know that you'd actually want to treat your own kid that way. Like, no, okay. So what if we didn't do that to ourselves? What if we weren't a jerk and weren't impatient and unkind? Would that make some sense to you? Yeah. Okay. I don't want to be not accountable. And we can unpack those definitions. So any self-compassion or however you want to describe that process is a necessary, but I don't necessarily think sufficient because now we're getting into the other things, which is what being in a toxic relationship with yourself and the world steals from you. What it steals from you is Nathanson called healthy pride. So think of a person who is trapped, and all the listeners who are listening to this, maybe this reflects upon you. Have you ever been able to take a compliment earnestly?
Yeah.
Like someone says to you, you know what? You're just like really smart. Are you like, thank you? And you feel it? Are you like immediately qualifying it, dismissing it, brushing it off? You're not internalizing it as a compliment. And in a way we can understand this is that people who are so lost in self-criticism, so lost in toxic shame, they can't take that information in. They can't take stock in a job well done. They can't take compliments. They can't have healthy pride, right? Because it just doesn't fit. So part of the work outside of self-compassion is actually building up healthy pride. So I've actually given instructions to clients, be like, you know, when you mow the yard, I want you to be like that middle-aged dad standing with your hand on your hips, looking at the yard, just going, that looks good. I did good. You know, that grass used to be tall. Now it's short and it's even. And look at those lines, right? And I edged the side. It's beautiful. You washed a car and your car used to be dirty and now it's clean, at least for like a few hours. But anything. Taking stock in a job well done is a form of healthy pride. Taking a compliment, which I used to and kind of still am terrible at, right? My de facto response to someone giving me a compliment is, I appreciate your kind words, which is a really sort of, I think, a nice response. But what that means to me most of the time is you're being nice,
right?
Which is different than I really thank you for noticing that about me. I am smart about this thing. Thank you. So healthy pride, which I don't think self-compassion directly addresses in its functioning, taking stock in a job well done is another way of saying that. That's huge with a lot of clients.
My tell in that, whether it's about the podcast or other work, I will say something akin to, well, we're better together. And it's really like, I'm one person, but I'm not the secret sauce here. And, you know, when we're distinguishing healthy pride from other forms of pride, narcissism, different traits that maybe we wouldn't want, selfishness, et cetera, we're looking at being able to accept our strengths and to really allow ourselves to celebrate that. And it doesn't sound like it should be such a hard thing, but it is. It's definitely a hard thing for so many people to just allow themselves to take the compliment. And that interesting because I feel like I look at my kids and if I'm like, you did such a great job, buddy. And they're like, I know, you know, where does that change along the road to, no, actually, it wasn't really me. It was because dot, dot, dot.
Yeah. Well, and you can see its connection to sort of scrupulosity. And I don't necessarily mean that in a religious context, right? Just sort of the over conflation of pride and narcissism. Like people who are prideful, people who have too much pride, people who are narcissistic, that's a problem, right? That's where the phrase, have you no shame, comes from.
Right.
Shame can actually act as sort of a regulator to narcissism, right? So we again, another version of healthy shame is to regulate narcissism. Too much shame leads to depression and despair.
Right.
So yes, healthy pride is very distinct from narcissism and unhelpful pride, where it's, again, too far in one direction. People, I think, as we get older, we tend to just paint with a broad brush around pride, that pride is bad. Like, there's one thing about going, like, our team won and we're celebrating. And it's another thing to rub the other team's face in it.
Right. That wouldn't be cool. Right.
Yeah. There's a point at which it's like, I don't know if it's in all sports, but I was having a conversation with my dad. I don't really follow sports, but some sports have like a rule where, like, if you're winning by a certain amount, you're done. Like, you're done. You don't just keep, you know, oh, now we're winning 600-4. Like, you don't, it's done.
Right.
Like that. And there's a point where it's like, you can't keep going.
Yeah.
Without being a jerk. So again, the point here is be able to take a compliment as it's intended to be. We can reflect on that and go, you know, yeah, I did do a good job on that. What accepting that and internalizing that as it is actually means for you in the context of working on shame. I think the other pieces we want to get to, like, so if we're going to organize this, because I like to think in an organized fashion, like, how would I approach this? It starts with psychoed. That's the first thing. That's the first intervention for all toxic shame is psychoeducation. And then after the psychoed is some kind of distress tolerance meets self-compassion. If I'm going to stop doing self-criticism, I'm going to feel like I'm not doing the right thing. I'm going to feel vulnerable. I'm going to feel discomfort. I need to learn how to feel vulnerable and discomfort. And there's distress tolerance skills. There's self-compassion skills. And even built into this is a kind of exposure. Mm-hmm. Exposure to whatever is there after I don't do my self-criticism. And okay, so I need to not be so phobic of those emotions. There's an exposure piece there. I think self-compassion also gets at this, but I'll explicitly mention it, which is social connectivity. Instead of isolating, we connect with others on some level and recognize that we're actually all more alike than we are different. And there used to be a show, I think they turned it into a podcast called Get Mortified. And it's just real stories of humiliation, embarrassment, and shame. And you listen to it, like, wow, I get why you felt that way. But me too. Like, you know, like, yeah. I had experience like this too. And I guess the last thing, again, there's probably a whole podcast you could do just on the different treatment approaches, but these general categories is humor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think humor, it's a cliche, but there's a lot of truth to it, that laughter is the best medicine. And an ability to laugh at a situation, that takes vulnerability, it takes humility, it takes some sense of pride and insight and all of that to be able to make light of it.
Yeah. I forget who said the quote, but I'll paraphrase it. Like, you know, if you can laugh at it, then you can change your relationship to it, that it becomes lighter. And I do draw a distinction because I can already hear some people sort of in their own heads going, well, I'm the butt of the joke all the time. Anyway, I pick on myself in a humorous way. I'm self-deprecating. And I think there's a difference between self-deprecation that is laughing with versus laughing at.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
You can bully yourself and hate yourself and then make jokes at your own expense. That's not what we mean. Humor is laughing with. I am in on why I am more alike with people than I am different, that this is not a secretive thing that I need to keep from the world, that this means some terrible thing about me. And if I can sort of recognize that, I can laugh with the knowledge that this isn't so serious.
Yeah, yeah, it's so true. Because it's kind of the difference between, well, first of all, it's inclusive when you're laughing with, but also not being cynical, right? Mm-hmm. That has that harsh cutting edge. Because again, cutting then goes back to self-punishment, and that's not meeting your goal. But being able to have an ability to laugh.
Yeah, that I hate myself and you should think that's funny is not what we're talking about. We're talking about, you know, that you're actually a good person, that despite discrete events where mistakes may have actually been made or more likely where your mind made shit up and made you feel a great deal of shame that needn't be there, that I can actually be in on that joke. I can understand in some ways the disconnect from who I am in reality versus what I thought I was, and kind of laugh at that. You know, there's a lot of comics that do this so well. Yeah. Where they take the self-deprecating route, but they're not hating themselves.
Yeah.
And what it does is it draws the audience in, like, we are you too.
Right, right, right.
And there's this togetherness in the humor that we can all sort of recognize sometimes the absurdity of the human mind, right?
Right. And that's similar to what then you were describing with the power of, you said it was mortified.
Get mortified is the name it used to go by.
Because people can relate and they're like, oh, not just me. And a little bit of, I'm glad that wasn't me in your situation. Yikes.
Anytime I would ever see a public speaker, whether it be in school or at a conference, and I notice that they, like, their face is getting kind of red and blotchy and they're getting a little sweaty. And I never was like, oh my God, what a terrible speaker. I was always like, ah, me too.
I'm not the only
right?
one.
Like, yeah. And sort of, I think the human condition is that we see the things in other people that we might call flaws or imperfections or things that sometimes people keep secret, like painful experiences or failures. And when you bring them out into the sunlight and let people hear about it, more people probably go, yep, I've been down that road.
Yep.
You know, and that doesn't have to mean I'm a bad person.
Right.
It can just be this sort of idiosyncratic fact about my life that then I relate to in a way where I can actually draw some humor from it.
Yeah.
Right. Again, not everything can necessarily draw humor, but the goal is to eventually get to a place where you're not so attached to this.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And so you can see how this course, it doesn't have to happen inside a therapy room, but because these beliefs can be so deeply ingrained and we're all dealing with different things. So sometimes our shame is going to clash with someone else's experience or definition of what's right or wrong. And so that's something where it can be incredibly helpful to have a therapist and have really a place to process that and learn more and see how the toxic shame is showing up and functioning in your life, be curious together, and be able to use some of these therapeutic approaches. We also see this come up in the family a lot too, because I feel like a lot of families share some similar shame beliefs. Certainly we can all have our own individual things, but families maybe instilled with a familiar message, ideological way of interpreting the world, different family experiences, different cultural experiences. And so any tips that you would have for family members that have or are aware, I'm sure we all have, but are aware of toxic shame rearing its ugly head in relationships?
Well, I think the compass still applies here, sort of a broad tool. Like, I'm watching the system have these ideas about shame that leads people to stop talking about it and sweep it under the rug, like the event, the situation that made people feel shame. I see that there's a lot of blame and attacking others. I see that there's a lot of just pure avoidance, or I see that there's a lot of self-criticism. And I think just pointing that out to people and just, are you aware of every time we start to talk about this situation, that the system goes into this toxic shame response, right? I can imagine this is true of someone in the family coming out as LGBTQ in the family. And then, like, if the family is coming from old school ideas, the system might respond to that information in a way that it looks very much like toxic shame and point it out, right? Again, there's a context under which you don't feel safe doing that, but I think anyone can do it if they're aware of it. And then that just leads to more curiosity. Well, what do you mean? And it's like, well, I think, you know, we're pretending like this isn't a thing.
Yeah.
And there's, which again, is another way of saying, just talk about it, but talk about it with a structure, an organization to it. That would be my off the top of my head response to that particular issue.
Yeah. And I've heard even in, like, that example that you provided, there's times where maybe a person is coming out to their family and their family is like, great, we love you. And that person may be like, but. And so you can see how shame can range. It's unique to the person. Sometimes it is reinforced by the broader family system, but sometimes it's going to be that own individual person's experience. But you can still use those tools and say, okay, well, how is toxic shame showing up in this? And what are some of these strategies that we can lean into after exploring how that's shaped our expectations? So much of the world is just about understanding, about managing expectations or releasing expectations, because they are heavy, usually pejorative, and their place isn't inherently bad, but it can create tricky situations.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Well, Mike, this has been a very interesting conversation. And family, if you want to learn more about Mike or any of the resources he talked about, I'm going to link over at this episode's blog on OCDFamilyPodcast.com. But of course, Mike, just thanks for taking the time. We always get into these longer conversations, but they're interesting. And so I will bid a compliment to you and say thank you for all you've done to help this community, as well as our professional community, but the OCD family community, in learning more about these different aspects of mental health. We appreciate you.
And I appreciate you and everything you do. And thank you for the compliment.
Thank you. And thank you for the compliment. I will receive it with some humor. How about that?
Yes. Thank you.
Intrusive thoughts. All right, fam. All righty. How about them apples? I really appreciated that conversation. Mike and I actually recorded this months ago. So it's really funny because across life right now, I can think of conversations I've had today about understanding our belief system, how it informs actions, thoughts, behaviors, and our sense of self, who we are, how we engage in the world. When we examine these things for ourselves, are we looking at self-corrective, self-compassionate, and functional healthy shame? Are we looking at healthy pride? So we kind of rub up against this scenario where, on one hand, we are so much harsher to ourselves and talk to ourselves in ways we would never say this to our loved one, to our friend, and we say it to ourselves. And then on the other hand, when we do receive that affirmation, we downplay it, we might dismiss it, we have a hard time accepting it. We engage in some form of self-punishment or avoidance instead of allowing some kindness and patience for ourselves. But guess what, fam? Here's the good news. Over time, we can learn how to break these patterns. We can build a healthier relationship with ourselves. So for today's intrusive thought segment, which is the application segment of my show for any newer fam joining us, I want you to think about this idea of healthy, functional shame, that self-corrective, not self-punishing, not self-diminishing, but that self-corrective shame. And I want you to find at least one example of when that shows up in life and how it benefits us. And if it's too hard to pick something in the present, then think about the past. But how has shame operated in a healthy way for you? I'll go first. So I was talking with my husband last night after I got off of work, and he was sharing something with me. And as he was sharing, I had a thought that bubbled up for me, and I started talking. And I had to recognize that I interrupted him. I talked over him. So for that moment, I was like, oh my gosh, that pit in my stomach. And then the look on his face, ugh, not loving that. So I noticed his reaction. I noticed my reaction. I have the pang of shame with me. But I also know I'm not a bad person because I did that. But I want to be a respectful listener. So how my shame helped to self-correct me in the moment was to go, oh, I'm so sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt. I apologized. I corrected it. And I didn't go into the rest of the evening going, shame on me. I'm a bad person. I'm a terrible listener. And that's kind of what I do for a job. So that's not great. What does that mean for me as a spouse, a mom, a sister, a daughter? No, because it wasn't an example of toxic shame. It was a, oof, I did something that didn't feel good to me, didn't feel good to my husband. And I self-corrected. I learned from it. And I'm moving on. And does it mean I will never interrupt again? My husband, if he's listening. Nope, that is not what that means. But I'm also not ruminating on it. And I'm not identifying as just this rude, inconsiderate person. No. And is it harmful or is it helpful when we can have these self-correcting, aligning moments that kind of help us navigate relationships in a healthy manner? No, it's a good thing. But shame definitely gets a bad rap. And toxic shame is, well, as the name would indicate, toxic. So I want you to think about that, family. I want you to name something where Shame is functioning, and you probably don't even consider it or think about it as shame, but I want you to identify when that shame is showing up. Because part of how we rework our understanding and learn that things aren't all bad, but there's some really good stuff in there, is we do this work. So another special thanks to Mike Hetty for coming and chatting with us about this really important topic. And thank you, family, for joining me. As I noted earlier with Mike, sometimes I do dismiss or have difficulty being vulnerable by saying we're better together. But make no mistake, family, I also take healthy pride in knowing we are better together. Because in social connection, in compassion for self and others, in humor, in expanding and opening up those self-expectations, and in being curious, I have to agree, we are better together. So thanks for being here. Happy Valentine's, and I'll see you next week. Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the download on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like Mike Hetty and me talking about shame to a T. That's right. I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. Therapists, ready to shape the future of pediatric OCD treatment? Join the Next Steps in Pediatric OCD on-demand course from Angela Adamson Springer, LCSW, and learn how to adapt inference-based cognitive behavioral therapy for kids. With research still emerging, this course empowers you to explore new methods and contribute to the growing field of evidence-based practices. With OCD Training School's 365-day access for on-demand courses, you'll gain practical tools to help kids by adapting ICBT's signature 12 modules to be as creative as the kiddos you're treating. So sign up at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to support the podcast at no extra cost and support further growth and hope for our youngest of warriors.